You're with SBS Radio.
I am Bertrand Tungandami on NITV Radio, and I'm in conversation with the University of Melbourne's Professor Michael Sean Fletcher. Professor Fletcher has been studying long-term interactions between humans, climate disturbance and vegetation at local, regional and global scales. I caught up with Professor Fletcher earlier this year in the sidelines of the devastating fires that ravaged large swathes of the country. We discussed the environmental devastation and the importance of Indigenous knowledge in environmental management. Professor Fletcher began by highlighting the importance of publishing the data that academics accumulate and also disseminating the information in the wider community to inform decision making.
A part of the whole ecosystem of academia is that, you know, part of our metrics is based around publishing. And, you know, these really technical and very important pieces of knowledge published in journal articles are often only read by a handful of people. You know, you may be lucky and a few hundred people might read your work. And it's definitely important in the accumulation of knowledge and the refining of understanding. But you're right, there's often a barrier, either real or perceived, to that knowledge filtering out to the broader public. And, you know, fundamentally, a lot of our research is funded by the broader public. So we really need to work at ways to get our story out in a way that's both faithful to the work and digestible to the broader public. So these sorts of workshops are really invaluable for that.
And I believe sometimes it's the language that is used in the papers that academics publish. It's a language that's unscrutable for most of ourselves in the general public. For the lay person, well, it comes with a lot of quotes and a lot of numbers and sometimes even a language that we don't understand.
It's the jargon. It's that whilst being economical, like, it really saves us time in our scientific publications because we speak to people who know what these terms mean, and it allows us to develop an argument in a scientific sense. It's, you know, virtually impossible for the layperson or anyone outside of our fields to understand. So it's really, really important for us to take a step back, break it down, and talk about our science.
And what's your area of specialty?
So I, more broadly, I focus on long-term environmental change, the evolution of landscapes, long-term climate change, long-term responses of ecosystems to changes, whether that be climate, whether that be the arrival of people into a landscape, whether that be changes in fire regimes, all of this sort of stuff. And I've worked right across the Southern Hemisphere focusing on various questions in that space. More recently, and actually woven all through my academic career the last couple of decades, I've been focusing on the role of Aboriginal people in both creating the landscape of Australia, but also very recently I've been focusing on what happened when the British invaded. Aboriginal management was pulled off the landscape in a very rapid manner. How the landscapes responded to that and what the effects are, what are we living with today that is a response to that really, really radical change in management regime.
And this is actually what we're going through. This fire season has been very catastrophic. The rain that we've experienced in Sydney, I don't know if you experienced what we went through this weekend, was just horrible. 3 days of relentless bucketing, unseen before. And just to go in the same direction as what you are saying, some Indigenous academics actually said Indigenous land care and Indigenous ecological knowledge is better suited to take care of land.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the millennia, you know, arrival dates now have been pushed back to 68,000 years of Indigenous occupation of Australia, mainland Australia, and probably 43,000 years, I think, in Tasmania, once the land bridge between Australia and Tasmania was exposed when people were here for them to cross. You have this systematic application of fire through a very, very, very long period of time through Australia, and then that sudden removal of that land management, of the fire stick farming, if you want to call it that, or cultural burning, which is what the term we use now. has allowed most of the landscape, particularly in the southeast, where colonization was most effective and the relationship with the land was really effectively broken in many places. You've seen forests just increase in fuel, you know, for the last two centuries. And then, you know, in the last few decades, we've made attempts at this thing called backburning or hazard reduction burning. That's occurred in a landscape that had already rebounded. There was already, in some places, have been an order of magnitude, which is 10 times the amount of woody fuel in a landscape now than there was under Indigenous management.
Yeah.
You think that's 10 times the amount of fuel. Then you couple that. So the current situation we're dealing with now is sort of resting on three pillars as you know, and fire science 101, there's a fire triangle. You need fuel, okay? You need the fuel to be in a condition that will burn. You need an ignition source. You need someone to light it. And at the very basics, you need oxygen. There's always oxygen enough for things to burn. So what's happening now is we have a lot more fuel in the landscape. Climate change is making it even more dry, okay? So it's really ready to burn. And you're getting people lighting fires, which has always happened. I mean, arson hasn't increased at all. Arson's always been a problem. So what we're dealing with now essentially are these problems of climatic change and too much fuel in the landscape. And areas that we know this by looking at areas that have either maintained cultural burning or reintroduced cultural burning, the impact of these latest fires was less. It's a different kind of burning than back burning, which is very much about asset protection and fuel reduction.
Yeah.
Cultural burning is imbued with a whole bunch of different things. There's country keeping, there's fuel reduction, there's promoting different types of resources at different times of the year. It's a very nuanced, very intelligent way of using fire continually, not just for a specific person purpose, which is reducing fuel, and it's done in an intimate way. And there's a strong argument that if we can reimpose that kind of management onto the landscape, then we'll be able to, we may not remove catastrophic wildfires because we're moving into a climate scenario where, you know, they're going to occur, but we definitely will reduce their impact potentially and potentially their frequency.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that. I was speaking to a gentleman in Melbourne. We haven't had a chance to actually have a yarn with him on radio, who is one of the few people who have been authorized through some agreement with the Victorian government to do some cultural burning, and they've been authorized to actually work on land, and they are very effective. So have you got any knowledge of these really traditional owners who are doing a fantastic land care and burning, cultural burnings like that?
Yeah, so I'm a part of this collective of all of the Aboriginal corporations in Victoria to tackle various issues, and one of them is cultural burning. And a lot of these, the Jaja Warong and other groups are now doing large-scale cultural burning. And you're not only reducing, this is the thing, it's one of the outcomes of cultural burning is reducing the potential for bushfires.
Yeah.
But the rest is healing the country, healing the people, reconnecting with land. All of these sorts of things have positive effects, not only on biodiversity, but the people living in a landscape.
Yeah.
So it's whilst it's not a panacea or a cure-all, it's definitely a way of approaching a number of potential problems in the environmental and Indigenous space of, you know, disadvantage, disconnection.
You
can set up ranger programs, and people have set up ranger programs, and that provides employment, provides a reconnection. And we know from work in the top end where this has happened that psychological and physical health of people doing the work improves.
It's
a bit of a no-brainer, really. And I've argued recently in Tasmania that we need to put this kind of methodology into the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area, which is not a wilderness at all.
It's just a land and it's habitat for human beings.
Yeah. And it was created by people, created by Aboriginal people. The landscape is, and that we see, you know, that each year, there's almost every year now in Tasmania, there's a threat to the Wilderness World Heritage Area from bushfires. And a large part of that is because fuel has just accumulated since Aboriginal people were removed, you know, 200 years ago, 192 years ago or something. There's definitely, we can be a lot more intelligent in the way that we engage with our landscape.
Yeah, cultural
learning has a big role to play in that.
Yeah. And now when we look at Western science versus indigenous knowledge, ecological knowledge, how do you, because you're educated in both, how do you reconcile them?
I think it's important not to force a reconciliation. Knowledge systems can exist in parallel.
Yeah.
Neither of them have to be right or wrong or validate one or the other. I think that's an important step. And I think in order to affect change in our governing agencies,
they're
a Western construct. You know, they need empirical science. So that's where a lot of my scientific research focuses, is developing the numbers to support the arguments that that traditional owners are making and all of this sort of stuff. So I can prove that following the removal of indigenous burning from a landscape, there has been a radical change in the amounts of fuel and the type of plants that are growing there. Then that provides empirical, you know, a numerical basis or support for reintroducing that cultural burning. It doesn't say anything about the ethos or the philosophy or anything underpinning the cultural burning.
Yeah.
It's just numbers that speak to the institutions that
are making make the decisions. Yeah. No, that's a very, very interesting. Before I let you go, can you tell us something that we haven't covered in this short conversation? Something that you would probably like to bring to the attention of our listeners.
Most recently, referring back to Tasmania, one of the things we've found is many of these, or large areas of these, what we might call ancient Gondwanan rainforests, you know, these forests that have plants that have relatives that go back millions and millions of years, are considered ancient. But what we've found is actually large areas of them only started growing following the removal of Aboriginal people. In the soil underneath these forests is charcoal and plant remains from grassy ecosystems. So what's happened is that essentially landscape that was being curated and manicured and managed by Aboriginal people using fire, holding rainforest out, has just been taken over. So in one context, some of these pristine rainforests that we, you know, we laud and we really place a lot of value on are weeds, if you like. They're weeds that have overtaken
invasive
previous.
Weeds. Yeah, they are.
I think it's a sobering thought about the way that the nature of this landscape, and hopefully will help tear down this myth of wilderness that I think is a barrier to a lot of the things that we're talking about.
Yeah. No, it reminds me of a story we had during the bushfires, just a shortly before or after Christmas, about the Butch Beam complex, industrial complex. It's actually a UNESCO heritage listed site of Aboriginal industrial activity, pre-colonial industrial activity.
The oldest aquaculture on Earth.
Yeah, and when it burnt, they found even more sites that were covered by all these outgrowth of vegetation.
Yeah, that's a... Have you been there? It's an impressive system. And then if you look at the early historical drawings from settlers and early colonizers, these eel trap networks were really extensive. You know, out near Garrywood, which is the Grampians, there were extensive eel trap networks. There's a lot more that have sitting there under, essentially we're dealing with neglected landscapes.
Yeah.
The weeds have just grown in, and a weed can be a weed even if it's a native species. You know, it's just taken over in a landscape where it wasn't. I wouldn't mind betting there's a whole lot more in that landscape, and the scale of industry, like you say, was really huge on that that lower Butch Beam.
Your community, your conversation, NITV Radio. Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.